15. The limousine drew up in front of a building with a green awning out front. Another man in another well-cut suit was standing by the door. The steps leading up from the sidewalk were blocked with yellow tape. There were words printed on it which Roland couldn't read. "It says, crime scene, do not enter," Mrs. Tassenbaum told him. "But it looks like it's been there a while. I think they usually take the tape down once they're finished with their cameras and little brushes and things. You must have powerful friends." Roland was sure the tape had indeed been there a while, 3 weeks, give or take. That was when Jake and Per Callahan had entered the Dixie Pig, positive they were going to their deaths, but pushing ahead anyway. He saw there was a little puddle of liquor left in Irene's glass, and swallowed it, grimacing at the hot taste of the alcohol, but relishing the burn on the way down. "Better?" she asked.
"Aye, thanks."
He reset the bag with the orizas in it more firmly on his shoulder, and got out with Oi at his heel. Irene paused to talk to the driver, who seemed to have been successful in making her travel arrangements. Roland ducked beneath the tape and then just stood where he was for a moment, listening to the honk and pound of the city on this bright June day, relishing its adolescent vitality. He would never see another city, of that much he was almost positive. And perhaps that was just as well. He had an idea that after New York, all others would be a step down. The guard, obviously someone who worked for the Tet Corporation and not this city's constabulary, joined him on the walk.
"If you want to go in there, sir, there's something you should show me."
Roland once more took his gun belt from the pouch, once more unwrapped it from the holster, once more drew his father's gun. This time he did not offer to hand it over, nor did that gentleman ask to take it. He only examined the scroll work, particularly that at the end of the barrel. Then he nodded respectfully and stepped back. "I'll unlock the door. Once you go inside, you're on your own. You understand that, don't you?" Roland, who had been on his own for most of his life, nodded. Irene took his elbow before he could move forward, turned him, and put her arms around his neck. She had also bought herself a pair of low-heeled shoes and only needed to tilt her head back slightly in order to look into his eyes.
"You take care of yourself, cowboy."
She kissed him briefly on the mouth, the kiss of a friend, and then knelt to stroke Oi.
"And take care of the little cowboy, too."
"I'll do my best," Roland said. "Will you remember your promise about Jake's grave?"
"Oh, Rose," she said, "I'll remember."
"Thank you."
He looked at her a moment longer, consulted the workings of his own inner instincts, hunch think, and came to a decision. From the bag containing the orizas, he took the envelope containing the bulky book, the one Susanna would never read to him on the trail, after all. He put it in Irene's hands. She looked at it, frowning.
"What's in here? Feels like a book."
"Yar. One by Stephen King. Insomnia, it's called. Has thee read that one?"
She smiled a bit.
"No, thee hasn't. Has thee?"
"No, and won't. It feels tricksy to me."
"I don't understand you."
"It feels thin."
He was thinking of Eyebolt Canyon, in Magus. She hefted it.
"Feels pretty goddamn thick to me.
A Stephen King book for sure. He sells by the inch. America buys by the pound."
Roland only shook his head.
Irene said, "Never mind. I'm being smart because Reed doesn't do goodbyes well, never has. You want me to keep this, right?"
"Yes."
"Okay. Maybe when Big Steve gets out of the hospital, I'll get him to sign it. The way I look at it, he owes me an autograph."
"Or a kiss,"
Roland said, and took another for himself. With the book out of his hands, he felt somehow lighter, freer, safer. He drew her fully into his arms and hugged her. Irene Tassenbaum returned his strength with her own. Then Roland let her go, touched his forehead lightly with his fist, and turned to the door of the Dixie Pig. He opened it and slipped inside with no look back. That, he had found, was ever the easiest way. 16. The chrome post, which had been outside on the night Jake and Per Callahan had come here, had been put in the lobby for safekeeping. Roland stumbled against it, but his reflexes were as quick as ever, and he grabbed it before it could fall over. He read the sign on top slowly, sounding the words out and getting the sense of only one. Closed. The orange electric flambeaux, which had lit the dining room, were off, but the battery-powered emergency lights were on, filling the area beyond the lobby and the bar with a flat glare. To the left was an arch and another dining room beyond it. There were no emergency lights there. That part of the Dixie Pig was as dark as a cave. The light from the main dining room seemed to creep in about 4 feet, just far enough to illuminate the end of a long table, and then fall dead. The tapestry of which Jake had spoken was gone, and might be in the evidence room of the nearest police station, or it might already have joined some collector's trove of oddities. Roland could smell the faint aroma of charred meat, vague and unpleasant. In the main dining room, two or three tables were overturned. Roland saw stains on the red rug, several dark ones that were almost certainly blood, and a yellowish curd that was something else.
"Throw it aside, nasty bauble of the heap god, throw it aside if you dare."
And the pear's voice, echoing dimly in Roland's ears, unafraid,
"I needn't stake my faith on the challenge of such a thing as you, Si."
The pear, another of those he had left behind. Roland thought briefly of the scrimshaw turtle that had been hidden in the lining of the bag they had found in the vacant lot, but didn't waste time looking for it. If it had been here, he thought he would have heard its voice, calling to him in the silence. No, whoever had appropriated the tapestry of the vampire knights at dinner had very likely taken the shawlpada as well, not knowing what it was, only knowing it was something strange and wonderful and otherworldly. Too bad. It might have come in handy. The gunslinger moved on, weaving his way among the tables with Oi trotting at his heel. 17. He paused in the kitchen long enough to wonder what the constabulary of New York had made of it. He was willing to bet they had never seen another like it, not in this city of clean machinery and bright electric lights. This was a kitchen in which Hacks, the cook he remembered best from his youth, and beneath whose dead feet he and his best friend had once scattered bread for the birds, would have felt at home. The cook fires had been out for weeks, but the smell of the meat that had been roasted here, some of the variety known as long pork, was strong and nasty. There were more signs of trouble here as well, a scum-caked pot lying on the green tiles of the floor, blood which had been burned black on one of the stovetops, and Roland could imagine Jake fighting his way through the kitchen. But not in panic, no, not he. Instead, he had paused to demand directions of the cook's boy.
"What's your name, Collie?"
"Jokabim. That be I, son of Hassa."
Jake had told them this part of his story, but it was not memory that spoke to Roland now. It was the voices of the dead. He had heard such voices before, and knew them for what they were. 18. Oi took the lead, as he had done the last time he had been here. He could still smell Ake's scent, faint and sorrowful. Ake had gone on ahead now, but not so very far. He was good. Ake was good. Ake would wait. And when the time came, when the job Ake had given him was done, Oi would catch up and go with him as before. His nose was strong, and he would find fresher scent than this when the time came to search for it. Ake had saved him from death, which did not matter. Ake had saved him from loneliness and shame after Oi had been cast out by the Tet of his kind, and that did. In the meantime, there was this job to finish. He led the man Olin into the pantry. The secret door to the stairs had been closed, but the man Olin felt patiently along the shelves of cans and boxes until he found a way to open it. All was as it had been, the long descending stair dimly lit by overhead bulbs, the scent damp and overlaid with mold. He could smell the rats which scuttered in the walls, rats and other things, too, some of them bugs of the sort he had killed the last time he and Ake had come here. That had been good killing, and he would gladly have more if more were offered. Oi wished the bugs would show themselves again and challenge him, but of course they didn't. They were afraid.
And they were right to be afraid, for ever had his kind stood enemy to theirs. He started down the stairs, with the man, Olin, following behind. 19.
They passed the deserted kiosk, with its age-yellowed signs, New York Souvenirs, Last Chance, and Visit September 11th, 2001, and 15 minutes later, Roland checked his new watch to be sure of the time, they came to a place where there was a good deal of broken glass on the dusty corridor floor. Roland picked Oi up so he wouldn't cut the pads of his feet. On both walls, he saw the shattered remains of what had been glass-covered hatches of some kind. When he looked in, he saw complicated machinery. They had almost caught Jake here, snared him in some kind of mind trap, but once again Jake had been clever enough and brave enough to get through. He survived everything, but a man too stupid and too careless to do the simple job of driving his buck on an empty road, Roland thought bitterly. And the man who brought him there, that man too. Then Oi barked at him, and Roland realized that in his anger at Brian Smith, and at himself, he was squeezing the poor little fellow too tightly. "Cry pardon, Oi," he said, and put him down. Oi trotted on without making any reply, and not long after, Roland came to the scattered bodies of the boogers who had harried his boy from the Dixie Pig. Here also, printed in the dust that coated the floor of this ancient corridor, were the tracks he and Eddie had made when they arrived. Again he heard a ghost voice, this time that of the man who had been the Harrier's leader. "I know your name by your face, and your face by your mouth. 'Tis the same as the mouth of your mother who did suck John Farson with such glee." Roland turned the body over with the toe of his boot. A Hume named Flaherty, whose da had put a fear of dragons in his head, had the gunslinger known or cared, which he did not, and looked down into the dead face, which was already growing a crop of mold. Next to him was the stoat-head Tyheen, whose final proclamation had been, "Be damned to you, then, Cherry Car." And beyond the heaped bodies of these two and their mates was the door that would take him out of the Keystone world for good. Assuming that it still worked. Oi trotted to it, and sat down before it, looking back at Roland. The bumbler was panting, but his old, amiably fiendish grin was gone. Roland reached the door and placed his hands against the close-grained ghostwood. Deep within he felt a low and troubled vibration. This door was still working, but might not be for much longer. He closed his eyes and thought of his mother bending over him as he lay in his little bed. How soon before he had been promoted from the cradle he didn't know, but surely not long. Her face, a patchwork of colors from the nursery windows. Gabrielle Duchesne, who would later die at those hands which she caressed so lightly and lovingly with her own. Daughter of Candor the Tall, wife of Stephen, mother of Roland, singing him to sleep, and dreams of those lands only children know. "Baby Bunting, baby dear, baby bring your berries here. Oh, chusset, chisset, chasset, bring enough to fill your basket." "So far I've traveled," he thought, with his hands splayed on the ghostwood door. "So far I've traveled, and so many I've hurt along the way, hurt or killed, and what I may have saved was saved by accident, and can never save my soul, do I have one. Yet there's this much. I've come to the head of the last trail, and I need not travel it alone, if only Susanna will go with me. Mayhap there's still enough to fill my basket." "Chasset," Roland said, and opened his eyes as the door opened. He saw Oi leap nimbly through. He heard the shrill scream of the void between the worlds and then stepped through himself, sweeping the door shut behind him and still without a backward look. Chapter 4. Fedic. Two Views. 1. "Look at how brilliant it is here. When we came before, Fedic was shadowless and dull. But there was a reason for that. It wasn't the real Fedic, but only a kind of Todash substitute.
a place Mia knew well and remembered well, just as she remembered the Castle Allure, where she went often before circumstances, in the person of Walter O'Dimm, gave her a physical body, and could thus recreate. Today, however, the deserted village is almost too bright to look at, although we'll no doubt see better once our eyes have adjusted from the murk of Thunderclap and the passage beneath the Dixie Pig. Every shadow is crisp. They might have been cut from black felt and laid upon the oven. The sky is a sharp and cloudless blue, the air is chill, the wind, whining around the eaves of the empty buildings and through the battlements of Castle Discordia, is autumnal and somehow introspective. Sitting in Fedic Station is an atomic locomotive, what was called a hot eng by the old people, with the words Spirit of Topeka written on both sides of the bullet nose. The slim pilot house windows have been rendered almost completely opaque by centuries of desert grit flung against the glass. But little does that matter. The Spirit of Topeka has made her last trip, and even when she did run regularly, no mere Hume ever guided her course. Behind the engine are only three cars. There were a dozen when she set out from Thunderclap Station on her last run, and there were a dozen when she arrived in sight of this ghost town. But, ah, well, that's Susanna's tale to tell, and we will listen as she tells it to the man she called Din when there was a quartet for him to guide. And here is Susanna herself, sitting where we saw her once before, in front of the Gin Puppy Saloon. Parked at the hitching rail is her chrome steed, which Eddie dubbed Susie's Cruisin' Trike. She's cold, and hasn't so much as a sweater to pull close around her, but her heart tells her that her wait is almost over. And how she hopes her heart is right, for this is a haunted place. To Susanna, the whine of the wind sounds too much like the bewildered cries of the children who were brought here to have their bodies ruined and their minds murdered. Beside the rusty Quonset hut up the street, the Arc 16 experimental station, do you not recall it, are the gray cyborg horses. A few more have fallen over since the last time we visited. A few more click their heads restlessly back and forth, as if trying to see the riders who will come and untether them. But that will never happen, for the breakers have been set free to wander, and there's no more need of children to feed their talented heads. And now, look you, at last comes what the lady has waited for all this long day, and the day before that, when Ted Brodigan, Dinky Earnshaw, and a few others, not Sheamy, he's gone into the clearing at the end of the path, say sorry, bade her goodbye. The door of the Dogon opens, and a man comes out. The first thing she sees is that his limp is gone. Next, she notices his new blue jeans and shirt. Nifty duds, but he's otherwise as ill-prepared for this cold weather as she is. In his arms, the newcomer holds a furry animal with its ears cocked. That much is well, but the boy, who should be holding the animal, is absent. No boy. And her heart fills with sorrow. Not surprise, however, because she has known, just as yonder man, yonder cherry man, would have known had she been the one to pass from the path. She slips down from her seat on her hands and the stumps of her legs. She hoists herself off the boardwalk and into the street. There she raises her hand and waves it over her head. "Roland!" she cries. "Hey, gunslinger, I'm over here!" He sees her and waves back. Then he bends and puts down the animal, oi, races toward her, hell-bent for election, head down, ears flat against his skull, running with the speed and low-slung, leaping grace of a weasel on a crust of snow. While he's still 7 feet away from her, seven at least, he jumps into the air, his shadow flying fleetly over the packed dirt of the street. She grabs him like a deep receiver hauling in a Hail Mary pass. The force of his forward motion knocks the breath from her and bowls her over in a puff of dust, but the first breath she's able to take in goes back out as laughter. She's still laughing as he stands with his stubby front legs on her chest and his stubby rear ones on her belly, ears up, squiggly tail wagging, licking her cheeks, her nose, her eyes. "Let up on it," she cries. "Let up on it, honey, for you kill me." She hears this, so lightly meant, and her laughter stops. Oi steps off her, sits, tilts his snout at the empty blue socket of the sky, and lets loose a single long howl. that tells her everything she would need to know, had she not known already. For Oi has more eloquent ways of speaking than his few words. She sits up, slapping puffs of dust out of her shirt, and a shadow falls over her. She looks up, but at first cannot see Roland's face. His head is directly in front of the sun, and it makes a fierce corona around him. His features are lost in blackness. But he's holding out his hands. Part of her doesn't want to take them, and do you not ken it? Part of her would end it here and send him into the Badlands alone, no matter what Eddie wanted. No matter what Jake undoubtedly wanted to. This dark shape, with the sun blazing around its head, has dragged her out of a mostly comfortable life. Oh yes, she had her ghosts, and at least one mean-hearted demon as well, but which of us don't? He has introduced her first to love, then to pain, then to horror and loss. The deal's run pretty much downhill, in other words. It is his balefully talented hand that has offered her sorrow, this dusty knight-errant who has come walking out of the old world in his old boots and with an old death engine on each hip. These are melodramatic thoughts, purple images, and the old Odetta, patron of the hungry eye and all-around cool kitty, would no doubt have laughed at them. But she has changed. He has changed her. And she reckons that if anyone is entitled to melodramatic thoughts and purple images, it is Susanna, daughter of Dan. Part of her would turn him away. Not to end his quest or break his spirit, only death will do those things, but to take such light as remains out of his eyes and punish him for his relentless, unmeaning cruelty. But Ka is the wheel to which we all are bound. And when the wheel turns, we must perforce turn with it. First with our heads up to heaven, and then revolving hellward again, where the brains inside them seem to burn. And so, instead of turning away... 2. Instead of turning away, as part of her wanted to do, Susanna took Roland's hands. He pulled her up, not to her feet, for she had none, although for a while a pair had been given her on loan, but into his arms. And when he tried to kiss her cheek, she turned her face so that his lips pressed on hers. Let him understand it's no halfway thing, she thought, breathing her air into him and then taking his back, changed. Let him understand that if I'm in it, I'm into the end. God help me, I'm in with him to the end. 3. There were clothes in the Fetic millinery and ladies' wear, but they fell apart at the touch of their hands. The moths and the years had left nothing usable. In the Fetic Hotel, quiet rooms, good beds, Roland found a cabinet with some blankets that would do them at least against the afternoon chill. They wrapped up in them, the afternoon breeze was just enough to make their musty smell bearable, and Susanna asked about Jake to have the immediate pain of it out of the way. "The rider again," she said bitterly when he had finished, wiping away her tears. "God damn the man." "My hip let go, and Jake never hesitated." Roland had almost called him the boy, as he had taught himself to think of Elmer's son as they closed in on Walter. Given a second chance, he had promised himself he would never do that again. "No, of course he didn't," she said, smiling. "He never would. He had a yard of guts out, Jake. Did you take care of him? Did you do him right? I'd hear that part." So he told her, not failing to include Irene Tassenbaum's promise of the rose. She nodded, then said, "I wish we could do the same for your friend, Shimi. He died on the train. I'm sorry, Roland." Roland nodded. He wished he had tobacco, but of course there was none. He had both guns again, and they were 7 Ariza plates to the good as well. Otherwise, they were stocked with little going on none. "Did he have to push again while you were coming here?" "I suppose he did. I knew one more might kill him. Cybrotigan did, too. And Dinky."
"But that wasn't it, Roland. It was his foot."
The gunslinger looked at her, not understanding.
"He cut it on a piece of broken glass during the fight to take Blue Heaven. And the air and dirt of that place was poison."
It was Detta who spat the last word, her accent so thick that the gunslinger barely understood it.
Goddamn foot swole up, toes like sausages.
Then his cheeks and throat went all dusky, like a bruise. He took fever. She pulled in a deep breath, clutching the two blankets she wore tighter around her. He was delirious, but his head cleared at the end. He spoke of you and of Susan Delgado. He spoke with such love and such regret. She paused, then burst out. We will go there, Roland, we will. And if it isn't worth it, your tower somehow will make it worth it.
We'll go, he said. We'll find the Dark Tower, and nothing will stand against us. And before we go in, we'll speak their names, all of the lost.
Your list will be longer than mine, she said. But mine will be long enough.
To this, Roland did not reply, but the robot huckster, perhaps startled out of its long sleep by the sound of their voices, did.
Girls, 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 it cried from inside the batwing doors of the Gaiety Barn Grill. Some are Humi and some are Saibi, but who cares? You can't tell. Who cares? They give. You tell. Girls, tell. You tell.
There was a pause, and then the robot huckster shouted one final word,
Satisfaction!
And fell silent.
By the gods, but this is a sad place, he said.
We'll stay the night and then see it no more.
At least the sun's out, and that's a relief after Thunderclap. But isn't it cold?
He nodded, then asked about the others.
They've gone on, she said, but there was a minute there when I didn't think any of us were going anywhere except to the bottom of yonder crevasse.
She pointed to the end of the Fedic High Street, furthest from the castle wall.
There are TV screens that still work in some of the train cars, and as we came up on town we got a fine view of the bridge that's gone. We could see the end sticking out over the hole, but the gap in the middle had to be 100 yards across, maybe more. We could see the train trestle, too. That was still intact. The train was slowing down by then, but not enough so any of us could have jumped off. By then there was no time. And the jump would likely have killed anyone who tried. We were going, oh, I'm going to say 50 miles an hour. And as soon as we were on the trestle, the fucking thing started to creak and groan. Or to queel and grail, if you've ever read your James Thurber, which I suppose you have not. The train was playing music, like Blaine did, do you remember?
Yes.
But we could hear the trestle getting ready to let go, even over that. Then everything started shaking from side to side. A voice, very calm and soothing, said, "We are experiencing minor difficulties. Please take your seats." Dinky was holding that little Russian girl, Danny. Ted took my hands and said, "I want to tell you, madam, that it has been a pleasure to know you." There was a lurch so hard it damn near threw me out of my seat. Would have if Ted hadn't been holding on to me. And I thought, that's it, we're gone. Please God, let me be dead before whatever's down there gets its teeth into me. And for a second or two, we were going backwards. Backwards, Roland? I could see the whole car. We were in the first one behind the loco, tilting up. There was the sound of tearing metal, then the good old Spirit of Topeka put on a burst of speed. Say what you want to about the old people. I know they got a lot of things wrong, but they built machines. They had some balls. The next thing I knew, we were coasting into the station. And here comes that same soothing voice, this time telling us to look around our seats and make sure we've got all our personals, our gunner, you can. Like we were on a damn TWA flight landing at Idlewild. It wasn't until we were out on the platform that we saw the last 9 cars of the train were gone. Thank God they were all empty. She cast a baleful but frightened eye toward the far end of the street. Hope whatever's down there chokes on them. Then she brightened. There's one good thing. At speeds of up to 300 miles an hour, which is what that ain't we happy voice said the Spirit of Topeka was doing, we must have left Master Spider Boy in the dust.
I wouldn't count on it, Roland said.
She rolled her eyes wearily.
Don't tell me that.
I do tell you. But we'll deal with Mordred when the time comes, and I don't think that'll be today.
Good.
Have you been beneath the Dogon again? I take it you have.
Susanna's eyes grew round.
Isn't it something? Makes Grand Central look like a train station someplace out in Sticksville, USA. How long did it take you to find your way up?
If it had just been me, I'd still be wandering around down there, Roland admitted. Oi found the way out. I assumed he was following your scent.
Susanna considered this. Maybe he was. Jake's more likely.
Did you cross a wide passage with a sign on the wall reading, "Show orange pass only, blue pass not accepted"?
Roland nodded, but the fading sign painted on the wall had meant little to him. He had identified the passage which the wolves took at the beginning of their raids by the sight of two motionless gray horses far down the passage, and another of those snarling masks. He had also seen a moccasin he remembered quite well, one that had been made from a chunk of rubber. One of Ted's or Dinky's, he decided. Shimmy Ruiz had no doubt been buried in his. "So," he said, "you got off the train. How many were you?"
"Five, with Shimmy gone," she said. "Me, Ted, Dinky, Danny Rostov, and Fred Worthington. Do you remember Fred?"
Roland nodded. "The man in the bankerly suit."
"I gave him the guided tour of the Dogon," she said. "As much as I could, anyway. The beds where they stole the brains out of the kids, and the one where Mia finally gave birth to her monster, the one-way door between Fedek and the Dixie Pig in New York that still works, Nigel's apartment." Ted and his friends were pretty amazed by the rotunda, where all the doors are, especially the one going to Dallas in 1963, where President Kennedy was killed. "We found another door two levels down. This is where most of the passages are, that goes to Ford's Theater, where President Lincoln was assassinated in 1865. There's even a poster for the play he was watching when Booth shot him. Our American Cousin, it was called. What kind of people would want to go and watch things like that?"
Roland thought a lot of people might, actually, but knew better than to say so.
"It's all very old," she said, "and very hot, and very fucking scary if you want to know the truth. Most of the machinery has quit, and there are puddles of water and oil and God knows what everywhere. Some of the puddles gave off a glow, and Dinky said he thought it might be radiation. I don't like to think what I got growing on my bones or when my hair will start falling out. There were doors where we could hear those awful chimes, the ones that set your teeth on edge."
"Toadash chimes."
"Yep. And things behind some of them, slithery things. Was it you or was it Mia who told me there are monsters in the Toadash darkness?"
"I might have," he said. "Gods knew there were."
"There are things in that crack beyond town, too. Was Mia told me that. Monsters that cousin, diddle, increase, and plot to escape," she said. "And then Ted, Dinky, Danny, and Fred joined hands. They made what Ted called the little good mind. I could feel it even though I wasn't in their circle, and I was glad to feel it because that's one spooky old place down there." She clutched her blankets more tightly. "I don't look forward to going again."
"But you believe we have to."
"There's a passage that goes deep under the castle and comes out on the other side, in the Discordia. Ted and his friends located it by picking up old thoughts, what Ted called ghost thoughts. Fred had a piece of chalk in his pocket, and he marked it for me, but it'll still be hard to find again. What it's like down there is the labyrinth in an old Greek story where this bull monster was supposed to run. I guess we can find it again."
Roland bent and stroked Oi's rough fur. "We'll find it. This fellow will backtrail your scent. Won't you, Oi?" Oi looked up at him with his gold-ringed eyes, but said nothing.
"Anyway," she went on, "Ted and the others touched the minds of the things that live in that crack outside of town. They didn't mean to, but they did. Those things are neither for the Crimson King nor against him. They're only for themselves, but they think. And they're telepathic. They knew we were there, and once the contact was made, they were glad to palaver. Ted and his friends said that they've been tunneling their way toward the catacombs under the experimental station for a long, long time. And now they're close to breaking through. Once they do, they'll be free to roam wherever they want."
Roland considered this silently for a few moments, rocking back and forth on the eroded heels of his boots. He hoped he and Susanna would be long gone before that breakthrough happened. But perhaps it would happen before Mordred got here, and the halfling would have to face them, if he wanted to follow. Baby Mordred, against the ancient monsters from under the earth, that was a happy thought. At last he nodded for Susanna to go on.
"We heard Toadash chimes coming from some of the passages, too, not just from behind the doors, but from passages with no doors to block 'em off. Do you see what that means?"
Roland did. If they picked the wrong one, or if Ted and his friends were wrong about the passageway they had marked, He, Susanna, and Oi would likely disappear forever instead of coming out on the far side of Castle Discordia.
They wouldn't leave me down there. They took me back as far as the infirmary before going on themselves, and I was damn glad. I wasn't looking forward to finding my way alone, although I guess I probably could have.
Roland put an arm around her and gave her a hug. And their plan was to use the door that the wolves used?
Uh-huh. The one at the end of the Orange Pass, Carter. They'll come out where the wolves did, find their way to the River Hwy, and then across it to Calibrin Sturgis. The Calafoken will take them in, won't they?
Yes.
And once they hear the whole story, they won't lynch them or anything?
I'm sure not. Henchik will know they're telling the truth, and stand up for them, even if no one else will.
They're hoping to use the doorway cave to get back America's side, she sighed. I hope it works for them, but I have my doubts.
Roland did as well. But the four of them were powerful, and Ted had struck him as a man of extraordinary determination and resource. The Manny folk were also powerful in their way, and great travelers between the worlds. He thought that sooner or later, Ted and his friends probably would get back to America. He considered telling Susanna that it would happen if Ka willed it, then thought better of it. Ka was not her favorite word just now, and he could hardly blame her for that. Now, hear me very well, and think hard, Susanna. Does the word Dandalo mean anything to you?
Oi looked up, eyes bright. She thought about it.
It might have some faint ring, she said, but I can't do better than that.
Why?
Roland told her what he believed, that as Eddie lay dying, he had been granted some sort of vision about a thing or a place or a person, something named Dandalo. Eddie had passed this on to Jake, Jake had passed it to Oi, and Oi had passed it on to Roland.
Susanna was frowning doubtfully. It's maybe been handed around too much. There was this game we used to play when we were kids, Whisper it was called. The first kid would think something up, a word or a phrase, and whisper it to the next kid. You could only hear it once, no repeats allowed. The next kid would pass on what he thought he'd heard, and the next, by the time it got to the last kid in line, it was something entirely different, and everyone would have a good laugh.
But if this is wrong, I don't think we'll be laughing.
Well, Roland said, we'll keep a lookout and hope that I got it right. Mayhap it means nothing at all.
But he didn't really believe that. What are we going to do for clothes if it gets colder than this? She asked.
We'll make what we need, I know how. It's something else we don't need to worry about today. What we do need to worry about is finding something to eat. I suppose if we have to, we can find Nigel's pantry.
I don't want to go back under the Dogon until we have to, Susanna said. There's got to be a kitchen near the infirmary. They must have fed those poor kids something.
Roland considered this, then nodded. It was a good idea.
Let's do it now, she said. I don't even want to be on the top floor of that place after dark.
4. On Turtleback Lane, in the year of 02, month of August, Stephen King awakes from a waking dream of Fedic. He types, I don't even want to be on the top floor of that place after dark. The words appear on the screen before him. It's the end of what he calls a sub-chapter, but that doesn't always mean he's done for the day. Being done for the day depends on what he hears, or, more properly, on what he doesn't. What he listens for is Veska Gan, the Song of the Turtle. This time, the music, which is faint on some days and so loud on others that it almost deafens him, seems to have ceased. It will return tomorrow. At least, it always has. He pushes the control key and the S key together. The computer gives a little chime, indicating that the material he's written today has been saved. Then he gets up, wincing at the pain in his hip, and walks to the window of his office. It looks out on the driveway, slanting up at a steep angle to the road where he now rarely walks. And on the main road, Route 7, never. The hip is very bad this morning, and the big muscles of his thigh are on fire. He rubs the hip absently as he stands looking out. Roland, you bastard, you gave me back the pain, he thinks. It runs down his right leg like a red-hot rope. Can you not say God? Can you not say God bomb?
and he's the one who got stuck with it in the end. It's been 3 years since the accident that almost took his life, and the pain is still there. It's less now. The human body has an amazing engine of healing inside it, a hot eng, he thinks, and smiles. But sometimes it's still bad. He doesn't think about it much when he's writing. Writing's a sort of benign toe dash, but it's always stiff after he's spent a couple of hours at his desk. He thinks of Jake. He's sorry as hell that Jake died, and he guesses that when this last book is published, the readers are going to be just wild, and why not? Some of them have known Jake Chambers for 20 years, almost twice as long as the boy actually lived. Oh, they'll be wild, all right. And when he writes back and says he's as sorry as they are, as surprised as they are, will they believe him? Not on your tintype, as his grandfather used to say. He thinks of Misery, Annie Wilkes calling Paul Sheldon a cock-a-doodle brat for trying to get rid of silly, bubble-headed Misery Chastain. Annie shouting that Paul was the writer, and the writer is God to his characters. He doesn't have to kill any of them if he doesn't want to. But he's not God. At least not in this case. He knows damned well that Jake Chambers wasn't there on the day of his accident, nor Roland Deschain either. The idea's laughable. They're make-believe, for Christ's sake. But he also knows that at some point the song he hears when he sits at his fancy Macintosh writing machine became Jake's death song. And to ignore that would have been to lose touch with Vescog Gann entirely. And he must not do that, not if he is to finish. That song is the only thread he has, the trail of breadcrumbs he must follow if he is ever to emerge from this bewildering forest of plot he has planted, and... Are you sure you planted it? Well, no. In fact, he is not. So call for the men in the white coats. And are you completely sure Jake wasn't there that day? After all, how much of the damned accident do you actually remember? Not much. He remembers seeing the top of Brian Smith's van appear over the horizon, and realizing it's not on the road where it should be, but on the soft shoulder. After that, he remembers Smith sitting on a rock wall looking down at him and telling him that his leg was broken at least 6 places, maybe 7. But between these two memories, the one of the approach and the one of the immediate aftermath, the film of his memory has been burned red. Or almost red. But sometimes in the night, when he awakes from dreams he can't quite remember, sometimes there are, well, sometimes there are voices, he says, why don't you just say it? And then laughing, I guess I just did. He hears the approaching click of toenails down the hall, and Marlowe pokes his long nose into the office. He's a Welsh corgi, with short legs and big ears, and a pretty old guy now, with his own aches and pains, not to mention the eye he lost to cancer the previous year. The vet said he probably wouldn't make it back from that one, but he did. What a good guy, what a tough guy. And when he raises his head from his necessarily low perspective to look at the writer, he's wearing his old, fiendish grin. How's it going, Bubba? That look seems to say. Getting any good words today? How do you? I do fine, he tells Marlowe. Hanging in. How are you doing? Marlowe, sometimes known as the Snout Master, waggles his arthritic rear end in response. You again. That's what I said to him. And he asked, do you remember me? Or maybe he said it, you remember me? I told him I was thirsty. He said he didn't have anything to drink. He said sorry, and I called him a liar. And I was right to call him a liar, because he wasn't sorry a bit. He didn't care a row of pins if I was thirsty, because Jake was dead and he tried to put it on me, son of a bitch, tried to put the blame on me. But none of that actually happened, King says, watching Marlowe waddle back toward the kitchen, where he will check his dish again before taking one of his increasingly long naps. The house is empty except for the two of them, and under those circumstances he often talks to himself. I mean, you know that, don't you? That none of it actually happened.
He supposes he does. But it was so odd for Jake to die like that. Jake is in all his notes, and no surprise there, because Jake was supposed to be around until the very end. All of them were, in fact. Of course, no story, except a bad one, one that arrives DOA, is ever completely under the writer's control. But this one is so out of control it's ridiculous. It really is more like watching something happen or listening to a song than writing a damn made-up story. He decides to make himself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for lunch and forget the whole damn thing for another day. Tonight he will go to see the new Clint Eastwood movie, Bloodwork, and be glad he can go anywhere, do anything. Tomorrow he'll be back at his desk, and something from the film may slip out into the book. Certainly, Roland himself was partly Clint Eastwood to start with, Sergio Leone's Man with No Name. And, speaking of books, lying on the coffee table is one that came via FedEx from his office in Bangor just this morning. The Complete Poetical Works of Robert Browning. It contains, of course, Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came, the narrative poem that lies at the root of King's long and trying story. An idea suddenly occurs to him, and it brings an expression to his face that stops just short of outright laughter. As if reading his feelings, and possibly he can, King has always suspected dogs of fairly recent émigrés from that great I-know-just-how-you-feel country of Empathica, Marlowe's own fiendish grin appears to widen. "One place for the poem, old boy," King says, and tosses the book back onto the coffee table. It's a big one, and lands with a thud. One place, and one place only. Then he settles deeper in the chair and closes his eyes. "Just gonna sit here like this for a minute or two," he thinks, knowing he's fooling himself, knowing he'll almost certainly doze off. As he does. Part 4. The White Lands of Empathica. Dandolo. Chapter 1. The Thing Under the Castle. 1. They did indeed find a good-sized kitchen, and an adjoining pantry at ground level in the Arc 16 experimental station, and not far from the infirmary. They found something else as well. The office of Cy Richard P. Sayre, once the Crimson King's head of operations, now in the clearing at the end of the path, courtesy of Susanna Dean's fast right hand. Lying atop Sayre's desk were amazingly complete files on all four of them. These they destroyed using the shredder. There were photographs of Eddie and Jake in the folders that were simply too painful to look at. Memories were better. On Sayre's wall were two framed oil paintings. One showed a strong and handsome boy. He was shirtless, barefooted, tousle-haired, smiling, dressed only in jeans and wearing a Dockers clutch. He looked about Jake's age. This picture had a not-quite-pleasant sensuality about it. Susanna thought that the painter, Cy Sayre, or both, might have been part of the Lavender Hill mob, as she had sometimes heard homosexuals called in the village. The boy's hair was black, his eyes were blue, his lips were red. There was a livid scar on his side and a birthmark on his left heel as crimson as his lips. A snow-white horse lay dead before him. There was blood on its snarling teeth. The boy's marked left foot rested on the horse's flank, and his lips were curved in a smile of triumph. "That's Lamry, Arthur Eld's horse," Roland said. "Its image was carried into battle on the pennons of Gilead, and was the sigil of all in-world." "So according to this picture, the Crimson King wins?" she asked. "Or if not him, then Mordred, his son?" Roland raised his eyebrows. "Thanks to John Farson, the Crimson King's men won the in-world lands long ago," he said. But then he smiled. It was a sunny expression, so unlike his usual look that seeing it always made Susanna feel dizzy. "But I think we won the only battle that matters. What's shown in this picture is no more than someone's wishful fairy tale." Then, with a savagery that startled her, he smashed the glass over the frame with his fist and yanked the painting free, ripping it most of the way down the middle as he did so.
Before he could tear it to pieces, as he certainly meant to do, she stopped him and pointed to the bottom. Written there in small but nonetheless extravagant calligraphy was the artist's name, Patrick Danville. The other painting showed the dark tower, a sooty gray, black cylinder tapering upward. It stood at the far end of Can Can No Re, the Field of Roses. In their dreams, the tower had seemed taller than the tallest skyscraper in New York. To Susanna, this meant the Empire State Building. In the painting, it looked to be no more than 600 feet high, yet this robbed it of none of its dreamlike majesty. The narrow windows rose in an ascending spiral around it, just as in their dreams. At the top was an oriel window of many colors, each, Roland knew, corresponding to one of the wizard's glasses. The inmost circle, but one, was the pink of the ball that had been left for a while in the keeping of a certain witch-woman named Rhea. The center was the dead ebony of Black 13. "The room behind that window is where I would go," Roland said, tapping the glass over the picture. "That is where my quest ends." His voice was low and awestruck. "This picture wasn't done from any dream, Susanna. It's as if I could touch the texture of every brick. Do you agree?"
"Yes."
It was all she could say. Looking at it, here on the late Richard Sayers' wall, robbed her breath. Suddenly, it all seemed possible. The end of the business was, quite literally, in sight. "The person who painted it must have been there," Roland mused. "Must have set up his easel in the very roses."
"Patrick Danville," she said.
"It's the same signature as on the one of Mordred and the dead horse, do you see?"
"I see it very well."
"And do you see the path through the roses that leads to the steps at the base?"
"Yes, 19 steps, I have no doubt, Chasset. And the clouds overhead, she saw them too. They formed a kind of whirlpool before streaming away from the tower and toward the place of the turtle at the other end of the beam they had followed so far. And she saw another thing. Outside the barrel of the tower, at what might have been 50-foot intervals, were balconies encircled with waist-high wrought-iron railings. On the second of these was a blob of red and 3 tiny blobs of white. A face that was too small to see, and a pair of upraised hands.
"Is that the Crimson King?" she asked, pointing.
She didn't quite dare put the tip of her finger on the glass over that tiny figure. It was as if she expected it to come to life and snatch her into the picture.
"Yes," Roland said, "locked out of the only thing he ever wanted."
"Then maybe we could go right up the stairs and past him. Give him the old raspberry on the way by."
And when Roland looked puzzled at that, she put her tongue between her lips and demonstrated. This time the gunslinger's smile was faint and distracted.
"I don't think it'll be so easy," he said.
Susanna sighed.
"Actually, I don't either."
They had what they'd come for. Quite a bit more, in fact. But they still found it hard to leave Sayers' office. The picture held them. Susanna asked Roland if he didn't want to take it along. Certainly it would be simple enough to cut it out of the frame with the letter opener on Sayers' desk and roll it up. Roland considered the idea, then shook his head. There was a kind of malevolent life in it that might attract the wrong sort of attention, like moths to a bright light. And even if that were not the case, he had an idea that both of them might spend too much time looking at it. The picture might distract them, or, even worse, hypnotize them.
"In the end, maybe it's just another mind trap," he thought, "like insomnia." "We'll leave it," he said. "Soon enough, in months, maybe even weeks, we'll have the real thing to look at."
"Do you say so?" she asked faintly. "Roland, do you really say so?"
"I do."
"All 3 of us? Or will Oi and I have to die too, in order to open your way to the tower? After all, you started alone, didn't you? Maybe you have to finish that way. Isn't that how a writer would want it?"
"That doesn't mean he can do it," Roland said. "Stephen King's not the water, Susanna. He's only the pipe the water runs through."
"I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure I entirely believe it."
Roland wasn't completely sure he did either. He thought of pointing out to Susanna
that Cuthbert and Alan had been with him at the true beginning of his quest in Magus, and when they set out from Gilead the next time, Jamie de Curry had joined them, making the trio a quartet. But the quest had really started after the Battle of Jericho Hill, and yes, by then he had been on his own. "I started lone, John, but that's not how I'll finish," he said. She had been making her way quite handily from place to place in a rolling office chair. Now he plucked her out of it and settled her on his right hip, the one that no longer pained him. "You and Oi will be with me when I climb the steps and enter the door. You'll be with me when I climb the stairs. You'll be with me when I deal with yon capering red goblin, and you'll be with me when I enter the room at the top." Although Susanna did not say so, this felt like a lie to her. In truth, it felt like a lie to both of them. 2. They brought canned goods, a skillet, 2 pots, 2 plates, and 2 sets of utensils back to the Fedic Hotel. Roland had added a flashlight that provided a feeble glow from nearly dead batteries, a butcher's knife, and a handy little hatchet with a rubber grip. Susanna had found a pair of net bags in which to store this little bit of fresh gunna. She also found 3 cans of jelly-like stuff on a high shelf in the pantry adjacent to the infirmary kitchen. "It's sterno," she told the gunslinger when he inquired. "Good stuff. You can light it up. It burns slow and makes a blue flame hot enough to cook on." "I thought we'd build a little fire behind the hotel," he said. "I won't need this smelly stuff to make one, certainly." He said it with a touch of contempt.
"No, I suppose not. But it might come in handy."
"How?"
"I don't know, but—"
She shrugged. Near the door to the street, they passed what appeared to be a janitor's closet, filled with piles of rickrack. Susanna had had enough of the Dogon for one day and was anxious to be out, but Roland wanted to have a look. He ignored the mop buckets and brooms and cleaning supplies in favor of a jumble of cords and straps heaped in a corner. Susanna guessed from the boards on top of which they lay that this stuff had once been used to build temporary scaffoldings. She also had an idea what Roland wanted the strappage for, and her heart sank. It was like going all the way back to the beginning.
"Thought I was done with piggybacking," she said crossly,
and with more than a touch of debtor in her voice. "It's the only way, I think," Roland said. "I'm just glad I'm whole enough again to carry your weight."
"And that passage underneath's the only way through? You're sure of that?"
"I suppose there might be a way through the castle," he began, but Susanna was already shaking her head.
"I've been up top with Mia, don't forget. The drop into the Discordia on the far side's at least 500 feet, probably more. There might have been stairs in the long ago, but they're gone now."
"Then we're for the passage," he said, "and the passage is for us. Mayhap we'll find something for you to ride in once we're on the other side, in another town or village."
Susanna was shaking her head again. "I think this is where civilization ends, Roland. And I think we better bundle up as much as we can because it's going to get cold."
Bundling up materials seemed to be in short supply, however. Unlike the foodstuffs, no one had thought to store a few extra sweaters and fleece-lined jackets in vacuum-packed cans. There were blankets, but even in storage they had grown thin and fragile, just short of useless.
"I don't give a bedbug's ass," she said in a wan voice, "just as long as we get out of this place."
"We will," he said. 3. Susanna is in Central Park, and it's cold enough to see her breath. The sky overhead is white from side to side, a snow sky. She's looking down at the polar bear, who's rolling around on his rocky island, seeming to enjoy the cold just fine, when a hand snakes around her waist. Warm lips smack her cold cheek. She turns, and there stand Eddie and Jake. They are wearing identical grins and nearly identical red stocking caps. Eddie's says Merry across the front, and Jake's says Christmas. She opens her mouth to tell them, "You boys can't be here, you boys are dead." And then she realizes, with a great and singing relief, that all that business was just a dream she had.
And really, how could you doubt it? There are no talking animals called Billy Bumblers, not really, no Taheen creatures with the bodies of humans and the heads of animals, no places called Fedic or Castle Discordia. Most of all, there are no gunslingers. John Kennedy was the last. Her chauffeur Andrew was right about that. "Brought you hot chocolate," Eddie says, and holds it out to her. It's the perfect cup of hot chocolate, mit Schlag on top and little sprinkles of nutmeg dotting the cream. She can smell it, and as she takes it, she can feel his fingers inside his gloves and the first flakes of that winter's snow drift down between them. She thinks how good it is to be alive in plain old New York. How great that reality is reality. That they are together in the year of our Lord. What year of our Lord? She frowns because this is a serious question, isn't it? After all, Eddie's an 80s man, and she never got any further than 1964, or was it 65? As for Jake Chambers, with the word Christmas printed on the front of his happy hat, isn't he from the 70s? And if the three of them represent three decades from the second half of the 20th century, what is their commonality? What year is this? 19, says a voice out of the air. Perhaps it is the voice of Bango Skank, the great lost character. This is 19. This is Chasset. All your friends are dead. With each word, the world becomes more unreal. She can see through Eddie and Jake. When she looks down at the polar bear, she sees it's lying dead on its rock island with its paws in the air. The good smell of hot chocolate is fading, being replaced by a musty smell, old plaster, ancient wood, the odor of a hotel room where no one has slept for years. No, her mind moans. No, I want Central Park. I want Mr. Merry and Mr. Christmas. I want the smell of hot chocolate and the sight of December's first hesitant snowflakes. I've had enough of Fedic, in-world, mid-world, and end-world. I want my world. I don't care if I ever see the Dark Tower. Eddie's and Jake's lips move in unison, as if they are singing a song she can't hear. But it's not a song. The words she reads on their lips, just before the dream breaks apart, are... 4. Watch out for Dandolo. She woke up with these words on her own lips, shivering in the early not-quite-dawn light. And the breath-seeing part of her dream was true, if no other. She felt her cheeks and wiped away the wetness there. It wasn't quite cold enough to freeze the tears to her skin, but just a damn bout. She looked around the dreary room here in the Fedic Hotel, wishing with all her heart that her dream of Central Park had been true. For one thing, she'd had to sleep on the floor. The bed was basically nothing but a rust sculpture waiting to disintegrate. And her back was stiff. For another, the blankets she'd used as a makeshift mattress and the ones she'd wrapped around her had all torn to rags as she tossed and turned. The air was heavy with their dust, tickling her nose and coating her throat, making her feel like she was coming down with the world's worst cold. Speaking of cold, she was shivering. And she needed to pee, which meant dragging herself down the hall on her stumps and half-numbed hands. And none of that was really what was wrong with Susanna Odetta Holmes Dean this morning, all right? The problem was that she had just come from a beautiful dream to a world, "This is 19, all your friends are dead," where she was now so lonely that she felt half crazy with it. The problem was that the place where the sky was brightening was not necessarily the east. The problem was that she was tired and sad, homesick and heart-sore, grief-struck and depressed. The problem was that in this hour before dawn, in this frontier museum piece of a hotel room where the air was full of musty blanket fibers, she felt as if all but the last 2 ounces of fuck you had been squeezed out of her. She wanted the dream back. She wanted Eddie.
"I see you're up, too," said a voice,
and Susanna whirled around, pivoting on her hands so quickly she picked up a splinter. The gunslinger leaned against the door between the room and the hall. He had woven the straps into the sort of carrier with which she was all too familiar and had hung over his left shoulder. Hung over his right was a leather sack filled with their new possessions and the remaining arises. Oi sat at Roland's feet, looking at her solemnly.
"You scared the living Jesus out of me," sighed Deshane, she said.
"You've been crying."
"Isn't any of your never mind if I have been or if I haven't?"
"We'll feel better once we're out of here," he said. Fedix curdled. She knew exactly what he meant. The wind had kicked up fierce in the night, and when it screamed around the eaves of the hotel and the saloon next door, it had sounded to Susanna like the screams of children. Wee ones, so lost in time and space they would never find their way home.
"All right, but Roland, before we cross the street and go into that Dogon, I want your promise on one thing."
"What promise would you have?"
"If something looks like getting us, some monster out of the devil's arse, or one from the toadash between lands, you put a bullet in my head before it happens. When it comes to yourself, you can do whatever you want, but what are you holding that out for?"
It was one of his revolvers.
"Because I'm only really good with one of them these days. And because I won't be the one to take your life. If you should decide to do it yourself, however—"
"Roland, your fucked-up scruples never cease to amaze me," she said. Then she took the gun with one hand and pointed to the harness with the other. "As for that thing, if you think I'm going to ride in it before I have to, you're crazy."
A faint smile touched his lips.
"It's better when it's the two of us, isn't it?"
She sighed, then nodded.
"A little bit, yeah. But far from perfect. Come on, big fella, let's blow this place. My ass is an ice cube and the smell is killing my sinuses."
5. He put her in the rolling office chair once they were back in the Dogon, and pushed her in it as far as the first set of stairs, Susanna holding their gunner and the bag of arisas in her lap. At the stairs, the gunslinger booted the chair over the edge and then stood with Susanna on his hip, both of them wincing at the crashing echoes as the chair tumbled over and over to the bottom.
"That's the end of that," she said, when the echoes had finally ceased. "You might as well have left it at the top for all the good it's going to do me now."
"We'll see," Roland said, starting down. "You might be surprised."
"That thing ain't going to work for shit, and we both know it," Detta said.
Oi uttered a short, sharp bark as if to say, "That's right."
6. The chair did survive its tumble, however, and the next as well. But when Roland hunkered to examine the poor battered thing after being pushed down a third, an extremely long flight of stairs, one of the casters was bent badly out of true. It reminded him a little of how her abandoned wheelchair had looked when they'd come upon it after the battle with the wolves on the East Road.
"There now, didn't I tell you?" she asked, and cackled. "Reckon it's time to start toting that barge, Roland."
He eyed her.
"Can you make Detta go away?"
She looked at him, surprised, then used her memory to replay the last thing she had said. She flushed.
"Yes," she said in a remarkably small voice. "Say sorry, Roland."
He picked her up and got her settled into the harness. Then they went on. As unpleasant as it was beneath the Dogon, as creepy as it was beneath the Dogon, Susanna was glad that they were putting Fedek behind them. Because that meant they were putting the rest of it behind them, too. Lud, the Kalas, Thunderclap, Algolciento, New York City, and Western Maine as well. The castle of the Red King was ahead, but she didn't think they had to worry much about it, because its most celebrated occupant had run mad and decamped for the Dark Tower. The extraneous was slipping away. They were closing in on the end of their long journey, and there was little else to worry about. That was good. And if she should happen to fall on her way to Roland's obsession, well, if there was only darkness on the other side of existence, as she had for most of her adult life believed, then nothing was lost, as long as it wasn't Toadash darkness, a place filled with creeping monsters. And hey, perhaps there was an afterlife, a heaven, a reincarnation, maybe even a resurrection in the clearing at the end of the path.
She liked that last idea, and had now seen enough wonders to believe it might be so. Perhaps Eddie and Jake would be waiting for her there, all bundled up and with the first down-drifting snowflakes of winter getting caught in their eyebrows, Mr. Merry and Mr. Christmas, offering her hot chocolate, Mitschlag. Hot chocolate in Central Park. What was the Dark Tower compared to that? 7. They passed through the rotunda with its doors to everywhere. They came eventually to the wide passage, with the sign on the wall reading, "Show Orange Pass Only, Blue Pass Not Accepted." A little way down it, in the glow of one of the still-working fluorescent lights, and near the forgotten rubber moccasin, they saw something printed on the tile wall and detoured down to read it. "Roland, Susanna, we are on our way. Wish us good luck. Good luck to you. May God bless you. We will never forget you." Under the main message, they had signed their names. Fred Worthington, Danny Rostov, Ted Brodigan, and Dinky Earnshaw. Below the names were two more lines, written in another hand. Susanna thought it was Ted's, and reading them made her feel like crying. "We go to seek a better world. May you find one as well."
"God love 'em," Susanna said hoarsely. "May God love and keep 'em all."
"Keep 'em,"
said a small and rather timid voice from Roland's heel. They looked down.
"Decided to talk again, Sugar Pie?" Susanna asked, but to this Oi made no reply.
It was weeks before he spoke again.